From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's been a crazy presidential election year. Pretty much everyone agrees with that. And one of the craziest developments has been the rise of Evan McMullen. By now, you know McMullen is a youngish Mormon guy, single, went to BYU, was in the CIA, and decided as a pretty much unknown congressional staffer to run for president. He doesn't have any power, doesn't really have any money, still paying off his student loans, but he has decent timing. Other conservatives considered challenging Donald Trump for the presidency, but McMullen is the only one who's pulled the trigger. Look, he knows his chances, but he says he's committed to building a new conservative movement and a new generation of political leaders. And what does he mean by that exactly? Well, we'll ask him today. Evan McMullen is joining us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Evan McMullen may have been a little naive to decide to run for president, but he knows his chances. And he knows they're slim, though it's not impossible. He could win, even though he's only on the ballot in, I think, 11 states. One writer for the political website 538 pointed out there was actually a chance McMullen could become president if he wins Utah's electoral votes and Clinton and Trump tie. Slim chance, but the same odds as the Cubs coming back to beat the Giants in the baseball playoffs, and you know how that story turned out. But McMullen has said he's running because it's the right thing to do. He doesn't like or trust Donald Trump, and he wants to put pressure on the Republican Party to make some important reforms. McMullen is a conservative, and he said he wants to build a new conservative movement. Today in the program, we're talking about Evan McMullen, and we'll begin with the man himself, Evan McMullen, who's joining us now from a studio in downtown Salt Lake City. Evan McMullen, welcome to you. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I'm trying to identify, Mr. McMullen, that sort of clincher moment for you when you decided, not necessarily to get in, but when you thought you had to do something. And it seems like, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but Syria was a really important influence in all of this. Was that a clincher for you, the idea of Syria?
I don't know about that. I think the way refugees and the way Muslims have been treated in this election cycle was a contributing factor. Obviously, Syria has a large part of that. But there are bigger issues at play here, which I keep talking about, the cause of liberty and the cause of equality, the idea, the truth that all men and women are created equal. When I see Donald Trump and hear Donald Trump attacking men and women who are Muslim or Arabs or Hispanics or you name it, that's something that I strongly object to and believe that we all should stand up to, and certainly our leaders should. Now, heading into the decision, this is not something I intended to do. I thought most likely I would probably quit my job in Congress and and then support another candidate, perhaps Mitt Romney, who I had hoped would do this. Yeah. But in the end, that didn't happen. And contrary to your introduction about my being naive about it, I don't think that's the case at all. I knew exactly how hard it would be and how long the odds would be of certain outcomes. But I believe that it was important for somebody to stand up on principle in this election for the very principles that I mentioned before, those that have made our country the most powerful and prosperous on earth. And I believe that my standing on principle has been validated by so many Americans who have responded so positively and with such energy in response to our campaign.
So I guess this idea that you weren't naive, you knew what the reaction would be from the establishment. I read this profile that said that you called your supervisors in Congress. You were working as policy director for the House Republican Conference.
That's right.
And you called Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers, a congresswoman in Washington State, and Congressman Ed Royce in California. They were your supervisors to tell them what you were going to do. And the profile that I had read said they hadn't yet returned your call. Is that still the case? And how do you describe the reaction that you got?
Well, Chairman Royce was somebody I worked for before when I was a senior advisor on national security issues. When I decided to launch the campaign, I was the chief policy director for the House Republicans, which is a role controlled by Representative Kathy McMorris Rodgers. And yes, I called a few hours before launching the campaign, and due to the time difference, I was on the East Coast, she was on the West Coast, and it was early in the morning, so there was just wasn't a likelihood of us connecting. I think if there was any naivete, I prefer to consider it just simple hope that our leaders will do the right thing. I did hope that Republican leaders would, some of them, would support this effort simply on principle, because I certainly share their ideas and the hope for this country that they have that I don't believe Donald Trump shares in any way. And so, but that didn't happen, yeah. And I think it is very disappointing. It's something I talk about on the campaign trail, and it's something that I think has also validated this idea that I and my running mate Mindy Finn and my whole team has, that it is time for a new generation of leadership in this country. We need leaders who will put the interests of the American people first, leaders who won't put party and power over the interests of the American people, and unfortunately today we don't have that.
I want to ask you about growing up in Auburn, Washington, as you did. What was the thing that influenced you the most growing up? I would have to say it seems the LDS Church may have played that role, but is that true?
I think that's true. There are other strong influences. I think the type of parents I had influenced me a great deal. My father was an extremely hard worker, was somebody who never made an excuse for himself. You know, when we didn't have a lot of money, he was a college-educated computer programmer, but he married young and started having children young. So money was scarce. And I knew that. I was the oldest. I was around and could overhear those discussions at times. But he never complained. He just did what he needed to do. He got a paper route for a while. And I remember, you know, he was paid in quarters. And sometimes my brother and I would go out with him and help him early in the morning, these cold Washington mornings, you know, starting at 3 a.m. And from 3 to 6, we would deliver papers with him out of our old Volkswagen van. And then we lived on what I call a small farm. We had some horses and sheep and chickens and, a large garden, I suppose. And we worked very, very hard. So that was one thing that influenced me. My mother was somebody who always believed in me. She always was an advocate for dreaming big and then doing big, taking action to pursue those dreams. And that had a great deal of influence on me as well.
I read this story that you had, you wrote a piece for the, I think it was the high school newspaper, where you, as part of that process of writing the piece, you slept in the homeless shelter in town, which gives a sense of maybe your intensity, your sense of compassion, principle. Do you mind saying something about that experience?
Yeah, it was, I wanted to write a piece that would be authoritative. I wanted to know what I was talking about. I knew that that was a part of American life and American culture that I did not understand. I just, we struggled growing up, but not like that. Yeah. And so I wanted to do it. And I did it for a couple of nights only, but it taught me a lot. And it was over the Thanksgiving break. And I remember telling my advisor, my newspaper advisor, that I was going to do that. And I think she sought approval from the principal. And actually, looking back on it, I'm surprised they approved it. but I remember I had a couple of experiences that really had an impact on me and that still remain with me. One of them was that I was unprepared for the cold nights that I would experience on those two nights. I dressed what I thought would be sufficiently, and I thought I would keep warm. Well, I was wrong. And as I was sitting on a park bench around some actual homeless men, they had shopping carts full of things that they had gathered. One man pulled out, seeing that I was very, very cold, pulled out a sweatshirt from his cart. And perhaps poetically and ironically, it said Thanksgiving on it. Hmm. And I think that taught me something about gratitude. That it's possible to have gratitude even when you have so little.
You know, I wondered. how did your sense of maybe social justice isn't the way you sort of looked at that? But you often hear that, quote. It's attributed to Churchill, but I'm sure it probably is just apocryphal. But that idea that if you aren't a liberal when you're young, you have no heart. If you aren't a conservative, by the time you're middle-aged, you have no head. Like this idea of compassion, which seems to be a theme for you. How is it that that didn't make you a liberal instead of a conservative when you were young?
Well, it's a fair question, but I think it reflects the traditional way we think about liberals and conservatives. In my view, true conservative principles encompass compassion. For example, if you look at our anti-poverty programs in the United States, President Johnson declared war on poverty in the 1960s. We've spent over $21 trillion on those programs since. Our poverty rate then was about 15%. It's about 15% now. That's about 50 million Americans living in poverty. So the point is just that, you know, we as much as we've dedicated resources to that problem, we really are only helping people survive in poverty. We're not helping them overcome poverty. And so I think about things that, you know, policy positions that are more traditionally conservative, but not applied to these challenges. And I think that some of them could actually help people out of poverty at a greater rate. We shouldn't have 50 million people in this country living in poverty. Many, many of them are children. And so I guess that I don't look at the divide between liberal and conservative when it comes to compassion in the same way that a lot of other people do.
You, if I get this right, you saw a copy of 3 Days of the Condor with Robert Redford when you were a kid, and it's had some impact on you. Maybe it wasn't the deciding decision for you to go into the Central Intelligence Agency, but at some point in this process, you decided you wanted to be in the CIA or wanted to be a spy. Could you take me through that decision?
Well, sure. I grew up wanting to be a filmmaker, and my friends and I used to make movies with a couple of old school camcorders, and then we used to edit them on the camcorders and on the VCR. It was very difficult to do that well. But in my young mind, I thought we were very talented. I'm sure if I saw the films now, I would be embarrassed. But anyway, my dad would occasionally bring home movies that he would rent at Blockbuster when that's still how you watched movies. And we used to pop them in our old VCR and our television that used pliers instead of an actual handle to turn the channel with. And we used to watch movies. And one day he brought home this movie, and it just captured my attention. And I had a naive, sort of immature idea of what the CIA was. But it did motivate me to read a lot of books about the Central Intelligence Agency. And at a very young age, I developed a very deep knowledge of what the agency did and what its mission was and what its challenges were and all of this. And over time, developed a strong interest in working there and serving that capacity. Nobody in my family had served in the military, so I didn't have that tradition. And those books they acquainted me with the idea of serving the country, and that always became my idea of what service to the country would be for me, and eventually that's how it played out.
How do you explain Donald Trump as a phenomenon? I mean, you've heard the explanation from others that he's tapped into this kind of populist anger, or that he appeals to people with a strong nationalist bent. But you've said that that's just a symptom of this, what you've described as this greater disease within the party. And I wanted you to be specific. What are you seeing there?
Well, before I get to the disease, Donald Trump did give voice to people who have been forgotten in our economy. They are suffering from wage stagnation, the lack of job opportunities. There's a lot, of course, that goes into all of that, a lot of challenges that come from that. When you look at our opioid challenges in this country, a lot of these are associated problems. They're complex. These people have been forgotten. Donald Trump came in and gave them a voice, which I think is a positive thing and something that needs to happen. Our leaders need to do this. However, he didn't stop there. He could have stopped there or used that force to channel the country towards something very, very positive. But what he did is selfishly combine that justified frustration that those people were feeling and combine them with their deepest fears and darkest prejudices, some of that which exists among many people in our country, perhaps to some degree all of us. And what he did is something that many authoritarians, I do believe that he is a true authoritarian cut from the same cloth as the people who he most admires, Vladimir Putin, Saddam Hussein, Kim Jong-un, and others, according to his own words. You know, these are people who have used the same tactics, pitting race and religion against race and religion in their own countries in order to divide and conquer their own people. That's what Donald Trump has done. So he's been able to do that. In part because these problems exist still in our society, but then also because our leaders, especially on the Republican side, have failed to stand up to these diseases in the past. After 2012, the Republicans and conservatives knew that they needed to do something to appeal more to women and minorities and millennials. Unfortunately, they weren't able to do that, and as a result, and I think Donald Trump identified that and ultimately was able to exploit it in the way I'm describing.
Yeah. I want to ask about this new conservative movement that you have in mind and some of the reforms maybe you have in mind. Now, we sort of made a list this morning of reforms that we're hearing from some conservatives that they've recommended, things like increasing diversity in the Republican Party. Sounds like you're for that. Mm-hmm. Do you want to eliminate Obamacare entirely or just create sort of stronger market mechanisms for health insurance?
If we're going to address that topic specifically, then yes, I do think Obamacare needs to be replaced,
yeah.
but not necessarily. Look, I believe that people who have pre-existing conditions, we need to ensure that they can get insurance. There needs to be insurance reform on that and other issues. People who are vulnerable with complex conditions, we also need to make sure that they're insured. But I also think, you know, I hear people, one of the most painful discussions that I have on the campaign trail, which is a reoccurring discussion, usually it's with a mother who's holding a child or two, and she's telling me about how her premiums are through the roof and they don't have money for them, and at the same time their deductibles are so high that they just can't use insurance. And it's they are so frustrated. It's an attitude of despair. That's what I feel from them. And so I think we have to do better. I think we can do better. Obamacare didn't do much about lowering the cost of health care. We need price transparency. We need people who don't have insurance through their employers to be able, I think, to get an advanceable tax credit that will help them buy insurance on the open market. And we need expanded access to HSAs and expanded ability to use the money from HSAs on a broader range of types of healthcare packages of healthcare from providers and whatnot. So yes, I do think we need to replace it with something that's more market based, patient centered, and something that will inspire competition, that will lower prices and increase innovation.
You've talked about being pro-life, pro-free trade, fairly hawkish on foreign policy. These are some pretty conventional sort of conservative ideas. Let me ask you about one recommendation that people are saying from conservatives are suggesting is that the party needs to just sort of talk less about same-sex marriage and some of these social issues. I wanted to get your sense of that. And we should point out, as I think a lot of people know at this point, your mother, I guess, is gay. She's certainly married to a woman. And I'm wondering how you're thinking about the question of same-sex marriage and how your sort of personal take on all of that is influencing how you're thinking about it.
Well, sure. Well, I hope that we can come back to the foreign policy issue. If not, I just want to say clearly that I think I'm unfairly painted as especially hawkish on national security because of my background.
Yeah.
I'm somebody who believes that in addressing humanitarian issues as well, I'm somebody who makes a case for humanitarian issues being as important and connected to national security issues that we think of traditionally. I think we need to find a way way to lead in the world that costs us less blood and treasure. You know, we tend to overcorrect by, you know, invading, for example, Iraq, which I've said it was a mistake, even though I served there myself, or by withdrawing U.S. leadership from the world entirely, which I believe President Obama has nearly done. And I don't support that either. I think we need
to. It sounds like you're a realist. Is that fair to say?
One always likes to think of him or herself as a realist, so I guess I could say that. But, you know, look, we need to lead. We can sort of ignore the rest of the world, but the rest of the world is not going to ignore us. We can close our borders, but whether we do that or not, Zika, Ebola, cyber threats, remotely inspired terrorists, all of this is coming our way, economic challenges. I mean, we can try to ignore the rest of the world, but the reality is the world is too small now. It's like saying that you don't care who lives next door. You never need to know them or care anything about what's happening over there. It's just not smart. If you care about even yourself, and even if you have no concern for your fellow man and woman, it's just smart to understand what's going on over the fence. And I think that many people would like to see us withdraw from the world, and I just think that's foolhardy. But on the issue of gay marriage, yes, my mother is married to a woman. She did that after I left the house. I was raised in a very traditional Mormon family at the time. But that happened after, you know, I grew up and left the house. And actually, I haven't changed my views on gay marriage. And people, I think, have a tendency to say, oh, well, if his mother is in a marriage to a woman, then he must – that must have impacted the way he looks at things. It really hasn't. And the way I look at things is the following. I believe that traditional marriage is important. For me, it's something that is a part of my faith. I believe it's even holy. And I believe that I ought to still be able to make that case, and people who agree with me ought to be able to make that case through persuasion. I believe that people who disagree with me also ought to be able to make their case. But I intend to do that. I believe that traditional marriage is very, very important. I also know that the court has decided on the issue.
Right.
And I've also said that I'm uncomfortable with the idea that we would use the force of law to force people, adults, to do what I might think is the right thing. And we all have free will, and of course there are limits on that. We can't harm each other with the free will, but it's an important part of human life that we all have free will to make decisions for ourselves, even if we may not all agree with them. Yeah. And I think it's also an important part of our country that we ought to be able to make our case through persuasion for or against any such thing.
I've got about 2 minutes left. I wanted to ask you, Donald Trump said recently, he said, I know the people of Utah. If they go enough for this character that's running all over the state and we lose the state of Utah, it's devastating because it means we're probably going to lose the Supreme Court. He calls you a puppet of William Kristol, the puppet of a loser in typical sort of Trump fashion. I wanted to get you to sort of respond to that. And then to the bigger question, people are saying dismissing your candidacy is kind of a fluke, that it's just this sort of Trump-averse Mormons. This is how McKay Coppins put it. Trump-averse Mormons simply supporting one of their own. So can you have appeal outside of the Intermountain West, outside of conservative Mormons?
We simply do. We simply do. And if anyone, I guess the facts and figures of our supporters are not available broadly, but we see it. Look, we're spending time in Utah as the election comes to fruition as we approach November 8th, because that's where we're strongest. We knew the Mountain West would be important to us because the people of Utah and elsewhere in the region rejected Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. If we had more resources, we don't have the backing of a party or major donors. We don't have any of that. If we had more of those resources, we would have been able to focus more broadly. But the truth is, we have organizations, quite developed organizations in Virginia, Wisconsin, Iowa, Florida, Minnesota, Nebraska, Texas, and other states. And we're building something that is very real. It's too easy for people to say, oh, this is just a Mormon thing because Evan's Mormon, yeah, and there are so many Mormons in Utah. But I would encourage people to disabuse themselves of that misperception, because our team is very diverse. Our supporters are extremely diverse, and that's what this is. And lastly, I would just say that there's sort of this attack on our supporters that, oh, they're just Mormon,
yeah,
or Donald Trump. Oh, these are people who, you know, Evan's a nobody and nobody knows who he is. I think Donald Trump and Mike Pence, who make these arguments, don't understand what leadership is about and what America is about. They're right. It isn't about me. And yes, I am a nobody, but I'm comfortable being a nobody, and I stand for the principles that have made this country great. That's what my campaign is about. That's what the people who are supporting me are about. It isn't about me. I'm happy to be a nobody. People are standing up because they love this country. They believe that all men and women are created equal, and they believe in the cause of liberty. That's what this is about.
Evan McMullen, you hit the post. Good for you. Thank you very much for being with us. He's an independent candidate running for president this year. Joined us from a studio in Salt Lake City. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
We're going to continue to talk about Evan McMullen and his chances for president, his positions, his desire to create this new conservative movement when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Evan McMullen, who, as you know by now, has caused a minor stir in this year's presidential election. He got into the race late, really late, entered in August as an independent, and he's only on the ballot in some 11 states. But he's certainly changing the dynamic in Utah, giving Utah voters another option besides Clinton or Trump. And as you just heard him say, he also has an appeal to other conservatives in other places besides the Intermountain West. He's youngish. He's Mormon, graduated from BYU, spent time in the CIA. He has a legitimate shot at winning Utah's electoral votes. And so we were talking to him about what he wants to do to build a new conservative movement. Joining us now on the program is Matt Canham, an investigative reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, specializing in politics. He's been covering the Evan McMullen campaign. Matt, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And McKay Coppins is back with us, senior writer for the BuzzFeed News Politics team, author of the book The Wilderness, about the battle over the future of the Republican Party. He's joining us today from his home in Brooklyn, New York. And McKay, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So how did this work, Evan McMullen getting into the presidential race? I hear it described two ways, that on one hand, he was recruited by these establishment conservatives like William Kristol to run. The other thing I had heard is that he approached them. Do we know, and does that necessarily matter? How did Evan McMullen come to be?
What Evan McMullen says is that he reached out to a group called Better for America, which was hunting for an independent candidate on the conservative side, to challenge Donald Trump. And this is a group that, as you mentioned earlier, conservative pundit Bill Kristol has been the biggest name behind. They tried Mitt Romney. They tried Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse. They tried some House members. For a while, David French, a columnist for the National Review, looked at it, and they got nowhere. In that process, Evan McMullen says he wanted to reach out and be a foreign policy advisor to whoever made that run. And when he did, they asked him to do it. And so he considered it over 10 days and decided that he felt strongly enough.
He's a no-name congressional staffer at the time.
Right.
It doesn't seem to have a whole lot of charisma or power or any money at all. Why would he be the guy that they default to?
Because I don't think there was anyone else. I mean, the way that Joel Serby is his campaign manager and a person who was really hunting for that, Evan McMullen identifies him as a man who has gotten used to rejection, because they asked many people and continuously got turned down. There was no one who was going to do this. And Evan McMullen decided to think about it. And as you said, there was some pretty good timing on his part. He realized that he would have to quit his job working for the House Republicans, and that if this did not go well, this would pretty much ruin him in certain circles. running as an independent and being mocked or going nowhere could have been very bad for his career. And he felt strongly enough that Donald Trump needed to be challenged by a conservative that he decided to do it.
McKay?
Yeah, so I think that's basically right, what Matt said. He was part of initially the group of establishment Republicans who was looking for a conservative independent challenger. The way he described it to me, and I've interviewed him a few times, the way he described it to me is basically that around the time of the Republican convention, it became clear that there wasn't going to be anyone else who stepped up. And he basically felt like it was extremely important that somebody did. And it's funny because early on, when he launched his bid, first of all, I don't think really believed. I interviewed him a few hours after he launched his bid back in August. I don't think he really believed that it was going to take off the way it did in Utah or really anywhere else. I think he thought that he would probably make a splash there because he's Mormon and has kind of roots in the state. But he saw his candidacy as a vehicle of reform, as a way to kind of stand for principle, restore kind of conservative principles to the Republican Party. And as the race has progressed over the last few months, he's become more and more disillusioned with the party as he's seen establishment leaders kind of line up behind Donald Trump, even though privately that they don't actually think that he would be a good president or they don't actually agree with his platform. And now he's, I mean, you talk to him a little about this, but he, you know, he seems increasingly like he's done with the Republican Party and might, you know, might actually be ready to start something entirely new.
Does he sound different, do you think, McKay? I mean, it's interesting. You talked to him in those really early days. He sounds a little bit more processed, a little bit more, I'll be honest with you, like a politician than I think I heard in those early days.
Well, actually, it's funny. My perception is a bit different. So when I first met with him that first day, he was incredibly careful about his criticism of the Republican Party. I remember we were in a bar in Midtown Manhattan. He was sipping Diet Coke. We were talking about all the Republicans who had kind of backed Donald Trump. And he was very kind of circumspect. He was kind of saying, well, you know, look, a lot of them just, they don't have another choice. They're kind of supporting the lesser of two evils. When I interviewed him more recently in Salt Lake City at his in his campaign headquarters, he was incredibly critical of the Republicans who were still standing behind Trump. I mean, he actually went back and forth. I wrote about this in a kind of story at BuzzFeed recently, but he and his running mate, Mindy Finn, who's a former Republican strategist, kind of took turns mocking various former Republican candidates who had backed Trump. So, I mean, I actually think he's become so more disillusioned with the party and more willing to talk about that in a way that I don't think he was at the beginning.
But do you think he is seeing his chances now as better?
I think he, well, so I, yeah.
I mean, he's realistic about his chances. Don't get me wrong.
Yes. I think that's true. I think also early on, he was still holding out hope that a lot of, you know, at least some prominent members of the Republican establishment would stand up and support his candidacy. And as it became clear that that wouldn't happen, I think he became a little bit more unbridled in his criticism of them.
So I wanted to get your sense, Matt and McKay, about his sort of what his upbringing, how that influenced the way he thinks about politics. He's talked a little bit about certain things.
Right.
Does seem to be pretty, I think, Matt, you used the word intense as a kid,
right?
Deciding to spend a couple of nights in a homeless shelter or writing a high school paper for the high school newspaper. That's pretty interesting. What are you seeing in sort of his upbringing? In some ways, traditional, conservative, but he's also deeply compassionate. Is it a lot tied to his sort of the Mormon element of it?
I do think there's a lot in the Mormon element of it, but I think the one thing as a personality trait is he's a man willing to act on his convictions.
He's mentioned that his father being willing to act.
I mean, I think that's the pattern that you see when you look at his life. A lot of people have conservative values or are very compassionate individuals. He, as you pointed out, wanted to know what the homeless experience was like, so he went and slept on the street. He wanted to be a CIA agent and be involved, so he did it. He wanted to get a sense of what it was like to work in the business community, and he got a job at Goldman Sachs. every part of his life, what you see is that when he feels that he, you know, that something needs to be done or he wants to accomplish something, he has been definitive in action. Which, I mean, I do think the oddest part about this whole thing is this idea of an unknown conservative congressional staffer saying, I'm going to run for president, or a independent presidential candidate hint that he might start his own political party and yet still seem like a pretty reasonable individual. Like, there's just a dichotomy there that is hard to grapple with. And I think the only way that I've been able to do that when you talk to him is that he's going to take action if he thinks it's right, and with an understanding that it might not work out the way that he wants, but the action is important.
McKay, what have you noticed about his upbringing that's impacting the way he thinks about things?
Well, I think that that's right. I think that, you know, I remember when he, in the early weeks of his campaign, I remember talking to another journalist, and we were kind of talking about how we were disappointed in how kind of, to lack of a better word, kind of responsible and sober-minded he seemed. Because in my view, if you were going to run this kind of complete long-shot protest bid against Donald Trump, you should be, you know, out there, up in his face, you know, pulling all kinds of stunts. And he wasn't really doing that. He was kind of just going through, you know, going through the motions of running like a normal campaign, except just in basically one state. And his interviews, like the interview you just had with him, was very, you know, kind of serious and normal. And he doesn't come off like a bomb thrower at all. But I think that it's interesting. When I was at one of his rallies in Draper recently, Draper, Utah, that was kind of the thing that had drawn a lot of people to him. They like that he is so, you know, down to earth and kind of just normal. I remember that it's actually the funniest thing that I've seen written about him was the Weekly Standard, the conservative magazine, did a profile of him. And they said, it cannot be emphasized enough how much of a normal person he is.
Yeah.
And that really kind of comes off, I think, except that, like Matt said, he's doing this, frankly, pretty crazy thing, which is running for president, entering the race in the final months of the campaign, basically. I do think, though, that, you know, you just talked about his in his interview, he talked about his mother being in a same-sex marriage. I think that there are various elements of his background and upbringing that I do think have I think compassion is a good word. I think that there's he has a sort of nuanced understanding and almost cosmopolitan understanding of the world that I think that is lacked in a lot of conservative Republican candidates that I've spent time talking to, that I think does come through in his own kind of unique way. And in a weird way has helped him to be the perfect foil or actually have Donald Trump as the perfect foil for his campaign.
So was it just – it's funny. It seems like it's great timing.
Right.
And terrible timing. Like if – like and the terrible timing part is what if he had done this, pulled the trigger to where he could have actually gotten on the ballot in more than 11 states?
Honestly,
or would it have hit at that time?
I mean, if he did it earlier, he most likely would have ran as a Republican.
Yeah.
He was a Republican staffer. Yep. He's helped Mitt Romney on Mitt Romney's campaign. Evan McMullen in a crowded Republican primary field likely would have gone nowhere.
Yeah.
One of the state senators in Utah, Lincoln Fillmore, who helped organize his endorsements here, said if Evan McMullen ran in the primary, he wouldn't have supported him. Essentially, his attention is because he is an outsider candidate. And the timing is that, particularly in Utah, the Republican Party here is very split. There are those who are staying home and are going to support the Republican candidate because they don't like Hillary Clinton that much, the Democrat. And then you have people who say that Donald Trump is an anthem to Republicanism, their conservative values. It's not who they can support. And they were yearning for someone who felt more like the candidates they tend to vote for.
Yeah.
And that's where Evan McMullen's normalness plays the best. He talks about the Constitution. He talks about small government. He isn't a loud, you know, big, figure. He is the type of Republican who wins office in Utah all the time. and it just feels comfortable for these voters. When I talk to them at multiple rallies, there's just a sense of relief from the people who are supporting him who are thinking they weren't going to vote, or they were looking at a third-party candidate as a protest vote, not someone they actually wanted, just someone that they – a place to go. And I think that he's giving them a place to land, and that's why we've seen him surge here.
But McKay, why – how is he different? I mean, if he's normal, if he has these policies that seem like sort of boilerplate conservative views, how is he proposing to reform the party and create some sort of new movement or new party? Like, what is that based on?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, first of all, I think that he's contrasting himself with the Republican nominee, who in a lot of ways is a dramatic departure from Republican orthodoxy on issues from trade to abortion to entitlement reforms. He's basically broken with traditional conservative orthodoxy. So, you know, you could argue that McMullen is actually representing what were the old, until this election cycle, what was the Republican platform. But I will say, interviewing him, listening to his interviews, watching his speeches, one thing that really stands out is the amount of time he spends kind of railing against the strains of racism and xenophobia and anti-religion bigotry that he feels run through a lot of the Republican Party and the conservative movement. And I actually think that that is a substantive departure from how most conservative Republicans talk about their own party and their own movement. And he gave an interview to the Washington Examiner recently where he said that basically the number one problem that needs to be solved with the Republican Party is the racism. It needs to be completely purged from the party's rhetoric, the party's messaging, the party's politics, and its positions. And he believes that if you stripped that out and really actually made the party more inclusive to people of color and you know, Muslims and immigrants, that the party could actually succeed. And you know, people have talked about that here and there for a long time in the party. He's talking about it. This is basically a central plank of his platform and messaging, and I think that does matter.
There's a piece in the National Review, a commentary piece from a writer named Maggie Gallagher, and the headline is Evan McMullen, conservative savior he's not. And she sort of goes through these sort of points to say that, in fact, he may not, in fact, be a legit conservative. She writes, in 3 years of Facebook posts, he never commented on a domestic issue, an economic issue, a social issue, never said anything on any specific issue that a diehard Democrat couldn't applaud. He's very pro-life, but the only policy he commits to is no taxpayer financing of abortion. He boasts of support for adoption, commits to virtually nothing concrete on any issue, much less religious liberty, trying, I suppose, to be a unifier through vagueness. So I guess this is natural, right? You're going to get some suspicion from conservatives.
You're going to try to get vetted in a couple months, and there's so little that you can actually go on for a man who spent 11 years in the CIA and then as a policy aide to Republicans, not exactly a position where you speak out a lot. Judging someone by their Facebook posts is a very limited way to judge someone, especially if the person just didn't do a lot of social media. I think McKay pointed out when Evan McMullen first ran, he had 130 Twitter followers. It's not like this is a man who was all over social media every day. And you know, so I don't know. I think that might be one way to go. Republican congressional leaders relied on him on a lot of policy issues, at least listened to him, put him in a key position. So they thought he was a conservative.
And I would add that he also was the nature of his job in the House Republican with House Republicans doing policy meant that he couldn't kind of freelance and go out and it was a lot harder for him to kind of be out on Facebook making his own case and critiquing various policy issues. He was basically a behind the scenes policy wonk, and his job was to toe the party line. And I think he did that for a long time. I will say that I am a little bit surprised that he really is not somebody who, at least in he's been the way he's been campaigning, he doesn't get into the nitty gritty of policy very often. And I know that, you know, you don't need to necessarily when you're campaigning. That's pretty common. But for a policy wonk, I would expect him to spend more time talking about kind of the nuances of policy. And he doesn't really that much.
Did you hear him earlier, McKay, talking about his sort of foreign policy credentials? He sort of pushed back on the idea that he was hawkish. I think he thinks of his positions as somewhat more nuanced than that.
Yes. And I think foreign policy probably is the area where he's most he talks about it the most because it's such a huge part of his resume and background. There, you know, that Washington Post story that came out discussing his time in the CIA, I think was fascinating. But again, this goes to Matt's point that even, you know, on issues like this, it's hard to vet somebody in such a short amount of time in the system that we have, especially when so much of his career is spent doing things that are classified and can't ever be, you know, talked about in public. I think that that's been a big problem. And it's also been the source of a lot of conspiracy theories that I can, you know, tell you, and I'm sure Matt can tell you, that have been spread from a lot of Trump supporters and Trump surrogates, saying that he's a Democratic plant, he's a Clinton plant, that he's come out of nowhere from the CIA. That a lot of this comes from the fact that he frankly just a lot of his career is classified and just can't be discussed.
Right. I think the best one came from Lou Dobbs, who said he's a Mormon mafia tool. I think it was.
Yes, that's right. Which I will say prompted one of my favorite recent hashtags on Twitter, which was Mormon mafia. I think that, you know, the thing is, a lot of these attacks, I actually think, only help him in Utah because there's such an aversion to Donald Trump and his kind of whole style of campaigning and politics that when Trump's surrogates and Trump supporters go after him, especially in this way, you know, talking about the Mormon mafia, it really only, I think, consolidates supports and kind of rallies his fans in the state.
McKay Coppins is with us, a senior writer for the BuzzFeed News Politics team. Matt Canham with the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take a quick break and come back for some final thoughts. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about and with Evan McMullen, who's running for president as an independent, has obviously had a strong showing here in the Intermountain West, but could he have a strong showing elsewhere? And does he have what it takes to create this new conservative movement? McKay Coppins, senior writer for the BuzzFeed News Politics team, is with us, along with Matt Canham of the Salt Lake Tribune. I wonder, McKay, you cite one study from Pew that suggests fewer than 50% of Mormons now identify as Republicans. I wanted to sort of get that point in, and I wonder, is that significant?
I think it is. I think that you have to be careful, obviously, in an election cycle. A lot of party ID answers to pollster questions like this are based on whoever's running for president at the moment.
Yeah.
And because there's been such an aversion to Trump by Mormon voters, a lot of people, frankly, just don't want to identify themselves with Donald Trump's party. It's also a big slide from 2012 when Mitt Romney was running, extremely popular with his fellow Mormons. I think I'd be careful to say that this marks a, you know, permanent and lasting departure from the Republican Party from Mormon voters. That said, you know, there is a sense that going forward, you know, one of the big questions after next week, whether Trump wins or loses in the Republican Party, and I can tell you I've talked to all of my sources across the party, they are bracing for, you know, a civil war, the likes of which they have not seen in the party in a long time. You know, I wrote a whole book after 2012 about the Republican Party in the wilderness and kind of the fracturing of the party. I think it could be much more dramatic this time around because Trump has basically given rise to his own movement, which is it is genuinely distinct from the old guard of the Republican Party. And so if there is a Trumpist wing of the party that, you know, starts launching congressional bids all over the country, that actually does kind of take control of party leadership, there really will be an appetite for something completely different from that. I think that this is when you talk to the people around Evan McMullen, his senior advisors, when they talk about the idea of starting a new party, a new center-right party in America, they're basically banking on that happening. They're banking on Trump redefining what it means to be a Republican and all of a sudden creating this entire new market in parts of the country, like the Mountain West, but also in kind of the suburban South, maybe the urban Northeast, where there are more moderate-minded, reasonable-minded Republicans who don't like Donald Trump, and they might be attracted to candidates in congressional or state races. Now, this is all a long shot, right? Yeah. I mean, this has to be said, but I do think that they're, you know, depending on how the party kind of rebuilds itself and reshapes itself after 2016, I think there could be an appetite for the kind of thing McMullen is talking about.
Does McMullen have the charisma I mean, once the fog is all lifted, right, what will the, you know, they see a white Mormon guy, not married, not terribly exciting. Is he the kind of leader to drive a new political party?
I don't know. I think that, you know, there is definitely a kind of Mr. Smith goes to Washington vibe to his whole candidacy, which makes him, you know, appealing for a while. But like in real life, Mr. Smith would not be, you know, launching a new party and running a sustained as a sustained kind of power broker in American politics. That said, I think that the idea would be that they would be they would show, if they could, especially if they could win Utah, they would show that there is an appetite for this kind of thing, that there are is a market for this kind of thing. And then they would go about people, you know, McMullen and the people around him, who include some serious disaffected Republican strategists, would go about recruiting other candidates, right? So they would look for candidates in these various states, in these various districts, ideally probably people with their own money who could kind of self-fund for a little while, maybe people who are prominent where they live, and get them to kind of launch bids and then take it from there. I don't think it would hinge entirely on McMullen and his kind of charisma and personality.
What do you think?
I mean, I think really what it comes down to after this election is what the Republican Party does. And as we've talked about a little bit, parties tend to shift a lot in very short order. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are not the same person. And Mitt Romney, Donald Trump are obviously not the same person. And if this starts to veer back in another direction, you know, I think that Evan McMullen's candidacy would be more of a one-off, that there would be a course correction. But if it's not, then I do think that there could be a hangover effect that goes on. We've had a lot of third-party attempts in the last 100 and more years in this country, and they all tend to fizzle over time. So is this a one-cycle, two-cycle deal, or is this something bigger? At this point, I would assume that at some point there'll be a course correction within the Republican Party, because what he's talking about are a lot of things that are Republican standards. It wouldn't be hard to see them moving back in that direction.
Matt Canham, investigative reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And McKay Coppins, senior writer for the BuzzFeed News Politics team, author of the book The Wilderness, about the battle over the future of the Republican Party, joined us from his home in Brooklyn. And McKay, thanks very much to you.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.